Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by our new deputy companies editor, Alex Newman. How are you, Alex?
I'm okay, John. How are you doing?
Good. Congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you very much.
And Jonas Crossland, our property guru. How are you, Jonas?
Very well today, thanks.
And you've written the cover feature this week, which is essentially an update on a feature you wrote About 2 years ago,
yeah.
The property forecast. So we've updated that to have a look at the outlook for the commercial real estate sector. In fact, not just commercial, some resi as well, but with a commercial angle for 2018 and onwards from there. Funnily enough, it's very convenient that we have you both in the room because every week on our 7 days page, we have a little bit of page furniture, good week four and bad week four. And the good week this week is Faro Petroleum, which you wrote about, Alex.
Yep.
And the bad week was Galliford Try, which you covered in the results, Jonas.
Sure.
Let's start with Faro.
Good news first.
Let's start with the good news. What's been going on at Faro?
So Faro Petroleum, which is a North Sea-focused mid-tier explorer and producer, had a couple of announcements this week. The first was the sale, quite a canny bit of deal-making, the sale of 17.5% of a stake in an oil field in the North Sea. They've sold that at what is quite a premium to the carrying value that was both on their balance sheet and also that analysts had estimated at. So the shares reacted quite well to that. I think the shares jumped by about 7.5p on the day. They suffered last week when we had the broad sell-off in equities and also a bit of a rout in the oil price. So that was a good recovery for what remains really has been one of the best performing shares in the space in the last couple of years. It's just another instance of Faro Petroleum just managing their portfolio very well. They never took on an enormous amount of debt like a couple of their peers. And, you know, this is just a sort of canny bit of horse trading, really, where they've made they've been able to book quite a big profit.
And presumably it's a vindication of some of the things we may have tipped it for in the first place, some of the characteristics of this company.
Yeah, I think one of the really important things this company is management, really, and their attitudes towards just managing the asset base, not getting overexposed in one area, having quite a wide portfolio of producing and exploration targets means they're not been overexposed in any one area. They've got a big stake and presence in Norway, which is very favourable fiscal terms for drillers there still, despite Norway's gradual pivot away from oil and gas. You know, we've retired the tip. It's been about 2 years in the making. We've retired the tip this week.
90% going.
89%. Yeah, I mean, it's traded higher than this, and we've kept it on a buy at higher levels than this. But we just felt that the catalyst this year may have subsided a little bit, but still a quality stock if you have it in your portfolio.
But you said sell.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, I mean, not everyone's necessarily going to take up our advice on every recommendation.
I mean, while we're talking about oil, there is a little piece in 7 days talking about US oil production and a surge in production. What is it? I mean, the oil price has presumably been a catalyst that has been helpful for Faro.
Yeah.
What does this mean for the oil price? Is this one of the catalysts that's sort of less strong than it was?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the $100 billion question for oil markets, really. It's how quickly can US onshore shale producers get back to the wellhead and start producing oil. The IEA report this week suggested that they're doing it a bit quicker than expected. That's bearish potentially for the oil price because it means that supply could return and that whatever OPEC does to hold back the huge surpluses we've seen in the last few years may be completely undone. So the jury is still out whether they'll, you know, these shale producers will exercise a bit more caution this time round remains to be seen. But, you know, they're enormously well supported by US capital markets, you know, and technology has improved in the last couple of years. So the fact that they're producing more than people expected could be a negative for oil prices this year.
Okay, and I noticed on our rise and fallers, which we have on the same page, you've got three oil related stocks that are in the faller section: Petrofac, Nostrum, and Soco. I mean, they might be company specific reasons, but
So Soco and Nostrum have been perennial underperformers. Nostrum, I've been quite worried really in recent weeks that their expectation setting has been quite poor in the last year, and they had this enormous gas plant that was meant to come online last year. Because of they missed a deadline there, and it gets so cold where the gas plant is meant to be that they basically had to say, well, we can't do anything until after after the snow's thawed. So that's enormous pushback, and they're now potentially running into certain debt issues.
Company specific, country and company specific.
Yes, well. Yeah, weather-wise, it is a country-specific issue, but a company-specific debt issues there as well. Petrofac, I mean, very, very volatile share, moves around a lot on the ongoing SFO investigation, which we've talked a lot about before.
Indeed we have. And, I presume you'll be rounding some of this up in the first sector report you're writing for the new Alpha product.
Yeah.
Which you're working on now.
My brain is flooded with oil and gas, even more so than normal.
We can tell.
Yeah.
We can tell. Let's move to the bad week. Galliford Try. This was a bit of a shocker there, really. And a couple of days later, that would have been up at the top of this fallers list that we have on this page. What's happened there, Jonas?
Well, Carillion's collapse has basically tarred the entire sector in the time-honoured fashion, and investors aren't very happy about what's happened there. And Galliford Try really kind of shot themselves in the foot, because last year they put 98 million quid aside for legacy contracts, which are basically fixed price contracts that they took out before 2014.
For doing what exactly, sorry?
For building things on the construction side.
For government type projects?
Oh, yeah, yeah, anything.
Okay.
But the point there is that because there's no business around and everything's flat, they do it on a fixed price basis, and then suddenly growth kicks in, inflation kicks in, costs kick in, and suddenly margins disappear. Well, they had three of those, and they've written off 98 million quid. And then when the results came out, they said, oh, by the way, we've got another 25 million, which is related to the joint ventures that we were in with Carillion. And we're also, it sounded like a good idea, but it wasn't, we're upping the dividend cover to 2x earnings, which basically means there was a dividend cut.
Yeah, no one likes to see that.
No, and the shares tanked. Crazy thing is they're not like Carillion. I mean, they haven't got a lot of debt. Carillion had a billion. They've got about 90 million. And they've also got a very vibrant Linden Homes, the house building side, which is going great guns. I think arguably you could say it's water under the bridge, and I'd be happy to sort of back Galliford to do well. But it's like everything else. If the sentiment's not there, then they're just not going to work.
Yeah, so you've got the sentiment, or the negative sentiment, on the kind of public sector side of things. But the house builders, there's not exactly warmth for the house building sector still, despite the fact that, as you say, Linden's been doing quite well. On the tip updates page, you've got an update from Bellway, which is very good.
Yeah, I mean, they're going from strength to strength. I think a cynic could argue that with Help to Buy, the government subsidising people who buy houses, and that promotes growth in the house building sector, and they give it to the shareholders via special dividends. But in reality, it's a simple demand and supply. We haven't got enough houses, and all the house builders are building more houses each year, 5, 6, 8, 10%. But they'll never bridge the gap, and they never have.
Yeah. I mean, this is a theme that which also comes up in the cover feature in the residential side of that. So we'll talk about that that again in a minute. Let's quickly turn back to the news pages, Alex, because as well as having your head filled with oil and gas this week, you've had a busy week on the mining front, particularly in South Africa.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone will be aware of the developments in South Africa this week, and we just wanted to take a quick look at how that may or may not impact the mining sector. The hope which seems to have, or the broad optimism which seems to be reflected in markets this week vis-a-vis share prices of South African-facing miners is that Cyril Ramaphosa, who is expected, or I think today confirmed, to be the next president...
After Zuma, who was essentially forced out.
Yeah.
Has he actually accepted that he's been forced out yet? Because I know there was a bit of toing and froing.
Yes, there. Right. So I think when we went to press, he hadn't yet, but last night he accepted the ANC's decision. So Cyril Ramaphosa, who has background in mining, he's seen as someone who may tear up a draft mining charter, which has, as it stands, it has basically left the whole sector, all the unions and government, at a complete impasse. So a draft charter was brought in last year, which had a range of measures, an extension to some of the black economic empowerment measures, which reflect in previous charters, but additional rules on procurement and exploration economic empowerment, which basically meant that the mining industry is no longer going to invest in South Africa, as you know, if that was going to be brought in. And black economic empowerment is an important part of the redress for South Africa's South African society and the economy. But the danger here is in trying to improve some of that situation, you end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah. But the hope is here that Cyril Ramaphosa will potentially scrap this charter or come to some sort of resolution between the sector and lawmakers.
Yeah, so we had already seen some impact on some of the listed miners from the previous regime, Pan-African Resources being the obvious example, which has reported this week.
Yeah.
And they were pretty ugly results.
They were ugly results. I mean, I suppose it's important to separate the different themes here, which are bogging down, which was quite a fraught sector, really, in South Africa. The rand has done very, very well in recent months as the dollar has been slipping. Miners sell their product in dollars. They have to keep their costs largely in rand. So that's left some of the gold miners, including Pan-African, Lonmin, who are having to be taken over by Sibanye-Stillwater, with wafer-thin or non-existent margins. So it's already a difficult operating regime. You have quite a tense standoff between the miners and unions already. The currency issues are probably not going to go away from all of this. In fact, if sentiment returns to investment in South Africa, it could be that the rand strengthens even further, which would be arguably worse news for the likes of Pan-African. But longer term, if you look at the share prices of Anglo American this week, Petra Diamonds, which is in a bit of a difficult situation, but should be able to get past its current impasse, then you can see a bit of sentiment returning. The idea that if a resolution will come about on the mining charter, then whatever the currency fluctuations are near term, the mining sector has a better medium to long term future.
But I mean, looking at your write up of Pan African, this is not one of our favourites in the sector.
It has been, because it's always looked very good value, and they also paid a good dividend, but their fortunes really have been on the slide for pretty much since we tipped them. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a falling knife situation, and they have also been hit by various issues with the mines themselves, so they're having to revise the mine plans there. So spending money at a time when margins are already shrinking, not a great time to be a Pan-African shareholder.
No, I mean, is this just a South African thing, or is it something we need to be on the lookout for across the sector, particularly those companies exploring elsewhere or exploring and producing elsewhere in Africa? I mean, we've had results from Acacia this week, and there's a bit of a standoff there between Acacia and the Tanzanian authorities.
Yeah, so in terms of mining legislation, This is a broader theme, and it's always important, I think, not to draw too wide a conclusion from what may be a standoff between a government in any one country and the rest of a continent. But yeah, certainly we have this, the issues in South Africa. If those are bad, what's happened to Acacia Mining in Tanzania is arguably, a lot worse. We've written and talked a lot about what has happened there very, very briefly. The government last March imposed a freeze on all concentrate exports of gold and copper, I think. So that basically means that Acacia can't sell half its production. And then you've just had the very predictable working capital and cash issues that have unfolded as Acacia has tried to steady itself and reduce its scale in the last year. So full-year results, predictably were pretty dire, and they've had massive impairments. If we look back to last week, Randgold also appears to be having some serious problems in the DRC. And the issue there, as it has been with Acacia and has been with South Africa, is not that the level of taxation or royalties are in and of themselves difficult. It's when the regime changes, it resets expectations. It means that projects which were approved 2 years ago no longer are going to be profitable. And it's, for equity investors particularly, I mean, you're being asked to commit over a very, very long term money where you're not going to receive return on investment for several years.
I was going to say, these projects do take a very long time to get off the ground in the first place and then actually put into operation.
Yeah.
So, much longer than 2 years.
Absolutely. So all these miners, what they really want is stability, really, which allows them to plan. You know, and that's not to cast any aspersions or negative view on any of the changes that the individual governments might want to make, you know, and the greater economic benefit they would like to see from the extraction of resources in their country. But when the goalposts shift, I mean, inevitably it's very difficult for the miners and their share prices as well.
Indeed. I sense a bigger piece coming on to look at this soon.
Potentially, yeah.
I'll give you a shout after this after this podcast. And to be fair, I mean, you could say that many companies are looking at Britain with the same kind of exasperation that there is no clarity on where we might be in 2 or 3 years' time.
Yeah, indeed. in terms of the extractive industry in the UK, I mean, I don't think there's too much to worry about that,
no, not really. But there are other industries which are much more exposed to the UK, and real estate, thank you, Alex, is definitely one of them. So let's talk about this week's cover feature. Jonas, you wrote about this a couple of years ago, just before, I think, to the the referendum.
Yeah.
Already there were some nerves.
There were some nerves, and we all sort of, well, I don't know, perhaps I got it wrong, but I got the opinion that we were going to vote to stay in.
I think most people did.
Yeah, and so it came as a bit of a shock.
I actually had a look at the, as I write in my editorial, with the FTSE 350 REIT index. And yeah, the Brexit vote hit it very, very, very hard indeed.
Mm.
But it has recovered to a large extent, partly because, as you say in your feature, and I think as you warned at the time, life will go on. We'll kind of get past the hysteria, to revert to looking at the fundamentals as we assess the various categories of real estate. And I guess that's what we've done here.
Yeah, I mean, there's been more changes in real estate, which, as you say, it's a very broad church, but there's been more changes in the real estate market completely divorced from Brexit. A good one is the internet, people shopping on the internet. The high street's having a bad time. Applications to open new shops is fallen for year after year, and obviously people like BHS going bust. It's a difficult market. So urban logistics, where people have warehouses to distribute goods which are ordered online, is booming. And because there's been a lack of construction in the wake of the financial crash, there's a big supply demand imbalance.
Let's put some names to that. Companies that have exposure to the high street versus companies that have exposure to the logistics. Let's look at the former.
London Metric, Segrow, people like that, which are building big boxes, Tritax big box rather, they're all benefiting from this, whereas the retailers are, they're coping quite well. But the thing is, the return on the big retailers or the retail mall landlords is a lot lower than elsewhere. So although they're not struggling too much, they're relatively unattractive because the returns are much, much lower than in these sort of urban logistic, student property is another one, primary health care. They're the parts of the real estate sector that are really buzzing along.
Yeah, that's an interesting one you mentioned there, primary care. Mm. This is a little subsector, and you've identified a few of these in the piece. You've got tourism, healthcare, student accommodation, and self-storage. Mm. But let's talk about these, because these are all really hot areas.
Yeah, I've just finished writing the results for primary health properties. It's an interesting statistic. The wheels of government grind slowly along, but if you go to an accident emergency centre twice in a year, that costs the NHS as much as your regular visits to the doctors for a whole year. So it makes sense to build primary health care centres, which are basically purpose-built buildings where you can go and get an X-ray, you can get minor injuries, etc., etc., etc. There's a pharmacy there, there's somewhere for old people to go and take advice. All the things that clutter up the A&E departments will be dealt with elsewhere. So the NHS will actually save huge amounts by spending modest amounts.
I mean, there is a big debate going on about NHS funding. In fact, a very prominent debate, you know, obviously some changes in government, or in fact no change, because Jeremy Hunt has in fact stayed on as health secretary, but he's taken on a new remit, which is the social care remit. But that's part of this. But, you know, so why isn't it happening? You know, if greater efficiency, spending money more effectively, and taking some of the pressure off A&E, which seems to be a particular pain point, why isn't the money flowing into this sector? And is it likely to start flowing at some point?
Well, it's not really fashionable to go down this line, but private enterprise is profitable or goes bust, whereas nationalised industries just struggle on because they don't have to be accountable. Pour another £20 billion into the National Health Service, you won't even notice a difference because it's enormous.
But if you pour £20 billion into primary health clinics that save the NHS money, then it might actually have an impact.
Yeah, it'd make enormous difference. So there's PHP, there's two others, Medics X Fund, and I can't remember the third one.
Sura.
That's Sura, yeah. But between them, they own not many primary healthcare centres, and there's 8,000 GPs in England and Wales, and half of them are, you know, semi-detached houses, etc. Not fit for purpose. They need to be replaced.
It's going to happen then?
Oh.
At some point?
Yeah, the reversionary element will happen, because what happens is that PHP and the others, their rents are based on the cost of new buildings, and the district valuer assesses those. But the trouble is there's very few new buildings, so they can't push up rates. But when they start to, possibly this year and definitely next year, the likes of PHP will make lots more money.
Indeed. Tourism, I don't think we really need to go into much detail here. It's Shaftesbury.
Yeah.
It's the West End. It's Chinatown. It's Carnaby Street. They own pretty much all of it, and tourists have been flocking to London like nobody's business, thanks to the weak pound.
Yeah, the weak pound, and also Crossrail is coming in, so it's going to be easier to get to. And there are a lot of people working and living around there as well, so it's vibrant.
Indeed. Students seem to be flocking to the UK still as well, despite warnings that Brexit may have put the brakes on that. I think UCAS have reported record numbers of applications this year, so good news for Unite.
Yep.
Another trend that doesn't show any signs of slowing. Let's talk briefly about offices, because this, I think, is probably the one that there's most question marks over. You know, the potential worries around an exodus of certainly city institutions from the UK has caused some fears here. Do we think they're misplaced, or do we think that there's some truth in it? We should be more wary of the office sector, subsector.
I think the banks are taking a pragmatic view. Two big banks have just taken new space in London, and the amount of overseas money waiting to invest in London is higher this year than it was last year. And 2017 was higher than 2016. Obviously, you know, the exodus of banks and bank workers simply hasn't happened. And the north of London, the tech belt is creeping in.
Yeah, this is Dermot London that's really benefiting from this little trend.
Yeah.
And I dug up some stats to kind of reinforce this point that, in fact, just as we've seen record student numbers, we're seeing record amounts of investment, I mean, general investment, flowing into technology, led by things like financial technology, into London. So very well-supported trend there as well.
And also there's the demand and the supply. If you look at the crane survey in London, if you take out all the cranes involved in residential and then all the cranes involved in pre-let, there's only three or four left. So, obviously, speculative development is not a good idea at the moment because of the risk. And the big guys like British Land Securities have basically de-risked their development arm by ensuring it's mostly pre-let.
So, basically, what you're saying is there's not likely to be a huge amount of new supply coming on stream.
No.
In London, or in fact anywhere else in the country. And so we're seeing rising rents, basically.
Yeah,
actually, London rents are falling. Looking at the study I have here from Cushman and Wakefield, but that could reverse. And elsewhere across the country, you're seeing some pretty substantial rent increases in the office space.
Yeah, you go to Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, Leeds, especially, and they're saying, "What Brexit? We've got Chinese money queuing up to get in. We've got a shortage of offices, residential, big box warehouses."
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you mentioned in the feature is that some changes to the permitted development laws in 2012-13, I can't remember what it was exactly, meant that you could convert more easily offices into residential. And there was a big spate of that, which has now sort of started to slow quite dramatically. But actually, residential is still an interesting asset class for institution investors, and in fact, a growing one. And there will be, you allude to, more ways for retail investors to play this as well.
Institutions, pension funds and the like have needed to find somewhere to park their funds and make it work. And with interest rates in decline, they've had to look at other ways. And obviously, buying property and collecting rent is a good idea, but obviously the guys like Legal in general don't know how to do it. So they've recently, well, in the last couple of years, conduits have been established whereby they can pre-fund construction programs and builders can build it and everyone's happy.
So they're getting a return, and this is translating into very good business for people like Telford Homes, Watkin Jones.
That's right, yeah. They go through the whole process from planning to management, and each part of the process is forward funded. Yeah, it's a win-win situation.
But of course, if you really want the best returns, you have to go to Germany, of course. And you've been on top of this trend for ages in the residential space. Yeah. The likes of Phoenix, Spree Deutschland, Summit Germany, Sirius Real Estate have all been doing incredibly based on the shortage of the scarcity of good residential rental property in places like Berlin in particular.
Yeah, I mean, they've got rent controls, so basically it wasn't financially sensible to build new property because you wouldn't make any money. But there's ways around it. Refurb and now new build, you can charge the market rate. So there's huge demand because of 2 million immigrants coming in, lack of new build. It's just a no-brainer.
Still as hot as it was? Still as attractive as it was?
I believe so, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, still got somewhere to go there.
Good. So, yeah, property, not the basket case that perhaps you may think in respect of the Brexit vote.
No, I think it pays, as always, to be selective. Some parts of it are on fire.
Yeah, and definitely worth a read. You lots of good ideas in this feature.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jonas. Let's get on the phone and talk to Simon Thompson. Hello, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. Great result for my team last night, Liverpool against Porto. Fantastic match. And switched on my computer screen this morning to find out one of my companies has been bid for, Stadium Group, an electronics distributor. And I advised the readers about 4 weeks ago to buy in the magazine, and the bid's about 45% above that level. So there's a theme developing here. So about 5 weeks ago, another one of my companies, Lombard's Risk Management, compliance and regulatory software, I think we've talked about that one before, that was bid for as well. So I reckon there's about 21 of my companies have been bid for in the last 4 years.
It's amazing, but I mean, presumably that's kind of what you would expect when you yourself are on the lookout for shares that are essentially undervalued in relation to their assets and trading prospects.
No, absolutely. And that's what you expect as well. As bull markets mature, the M&A activity actually picks up. And it's been a constant theme through this one over the last 3-4 years. So, hopefully the readers were invested in those two companies.
I'm sure a fair few of them were. Let's talk about what you've got in your column this week. Four companies. Pick a couple. I'll leave it to you.
A really interesting one is cash-rich insurance sector investment company BP Marsh & Partners. This company over the last 27 years has grown its net asset value per share by almost 12% each year, compound annual growth rate. At the end of July 2017, it was roughly £3 a share NAV. That was up 20% over the previous 12 months. I've been running through the numbers on this. We've just had a very bullish pre-close trading update for the financial year to end January 2018. And I reckon at least £3.30 to £3.35 NAV, and possibly as high as £3.50 a share.
Okay.
The share price is £2.60, so there's a thumping discount. The reason I'm so confident on those figures, I mean, there's no analyst research with the NAV figures. Panmure Gordon's the house broker, but they don't actually do a forecast. But the reason I'm confident on this is I've been running through the constituent companies in the portfolio. NAV is about £88 million. The biggest company accounts for £26 million worth of that. That's LEBC. It's IFA that's been growing at a fantastic rate over the last 3, 4, 5 years. I've just got hold of the trading update from LEBC. It's unlisted, but I can report that its trading profit in the last financial year, and wait for this, grew 42% to £3 million, revenue up 17%, about £18 million. Well, that company was valued by BP Marsh's valuation committee about £42 million at the last accounts. Well, it's just done £3 million worth of trading profit. So that's basically 14 times historic trading profit is what it's rated on. But get this, LEBC also reports, and I quote, current trading is significantly ahead of last year and budgets. It's also made an acquisition, £5 million of a Bristol-based advisory firm with roughly £500 million of assets under management. And I quote again, the deal is expected to be earnings accretive in the current year. And to put the undervaluation into some perspective, LEBC is basically trading on 14 times historic trading profit. Well, Mattioli Woods, which is listed, is trading on about 20, 21 times trading profit.
Mm.
There's a massive gap there. So I think the valuation committee of BP Marsh & Partners will be giving a pretty hefty uplift to that certain investment. The other one that they definitely will be doing the same to is Nexus Underwriting. It focuses on the speciality managing general agency side of the insurance market. That's made a number of very shrewd acquisitions, and I've got hold of its latest trading update as well. This is for the 2017 financial year. BP Marsh owns an 18% stake in this company. Well, I can report that this company is going to make cash profits of £10 million from commission income of about £23.5 million, and that's from gross written premiums of about £132 million. To put that £10 million of cash profits into some perspective, that BP Marsh's last balance sheet date, it valued the whole of Nexus at £107 million. So when you actually take a bit of debt into account that Nexus has on its balance sheet, in effect, it's being valued in 12.5 times cash profits to its enterprise value. And to put that valuation into perspective, Hyperion Insurance, which operates in this sector, sold its majority stake in CFC Underwriting in a private deal to a consortium of private investors and the management team, and the multiple was 22 times cash profits.
Yeah, hefty discounts.
Massive discounts. So when the valuation committee of BP Marsh actually look at these, which they're obviously doing at the moment ahead of the results, they're going to have to put in some big uplifts. And the story gets even better because the board, which have been raising the dividend anyway, have just declared a 26% hike in dividend per share to 4.76 pence. Share price is about £2.60. And it gets better because in the accounts, and I've been going through the last set of accounts, there's a £4.9 million deferred tax provision, which depresses that £88 million net asset value of BP Marsh in respect of unrealized gains and investments. But having agreed this with the HMRC, the company is now entitled to substantial shareholder exemption, which basically means that £4.9 million is released because it doesn't actually have to pay tax on those gains. And that credit alone is worth 16 to 17 pence on its last reported NAV of 304 pence. I mean, I honestly wouldn't be surprised if BP Marsh does actually report a net asset value of £3.50 and ahead of the results, it's got to be a buy.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like it could be another one that falls on, finds its way onto your takeover list because those discounts are, they sound like pretty good value to me.
Well, it's fantastic value for money. I just can't see any downside to it, John.
Okay.
The other one that I'm quite bullish on is Gresham House. It made it into my 2016 bargain share portfolio. The share price is roughly up 20-odd percent since then. The key thing now is that Justin Bates, an analyst at brokerage Liberum Capital, has published a note, and he believes that in the second half of last year, Gresham House actually hit run rate profitability. It's an asset manager. It's got forestry funds. It's got infrastructure funds. It's just bought Hazel Capital, which is renewable energy, battery storage, and including two VCTs as well. I reckon pro forma its assets under management, which were £242 million 2 years ago when I included the shares in my 2016 bargain share portfolio, I reckon assets under management are now well over £630 million. And Mr. Bates at Liberum believes that as a result of that, although the company will post a small loss in the last financial year, it's on track to make pre-tax profits of roughly £800,000 on management fee income of £8.5 million this year. And those profits could double in 2009 easily, given the operational gearing effect of the company. And the story here gets even better because Gresham House, when the new management team came into place about 2.5 years ago, had some legacy assets. Well, it sold all of those off. I reckon net funds of the balance sheet, roughly £14.6 million, no debt. It also owns a stake in Gresham House Strategics, which is another investment company, and that stake is worth £6.5 million. Strip out cash and that stake from Gresham House's own market capitalization of £50 million, and basically you're valuing a business that's on course to, which is already turned profitable, has hit that inflection point, but could actually double profits between this year and next and quickly thereafter. You're valuing that business that's less than £30 million. And in my book, that's just too cheap. So the share price of Gresham House is £4. I reckon the target price is £4.60. I'm also positive on Gresham House Strategic. Interestingly, I've been going through its portfolio. The shares basically trade on a near 30% discount to net asset value, but it holds companies that I'm really keen on, including Mighton Group, another asset manager that's done fantastically well for me, but the share price, 41 pence, is still shy of my 50 pence target price. But Gresham House Strategic also holds a stake in Challenger Bank, PCF, which is a constituent of my 2018 bargain share portfolio. There is a crossover between the holdings it's got and some of my holdings or recommendations. So I'm positive on that company as well.
Yeah, sounds interesting. And there's a couple more, as you've mentioned this week in the column, both actually in the sort of clean energy space, PV Crystalloxo and Leaf Clean Energy. But I'll leave readers to pick that up in the magazine. Thank you very much, Simon.
Oh, no, you're welcome.
The sun's come out today, isn't it? But it must be lovely down on the coast.
Oh, it's fantastic down on the coast, and it's going to get better tomorrow, I'm told. So all good for the weekend.
Lucky you. Well, thank you very much, Simon. Enjoy it.
OK, cheers.
Just to quickly talk you through what else we've got in the magazine. Results are cranking up. We talked through a couple of them. We're on about sort of 4 or 5 pages now. Definitely getting up there next week before we hit peak results in late February. John Rosier has updated his private investor diary this week. Not a good month, but it wasn't a good month for anybody after the big sell-off last week. But he explains why he is relatively unconcerned by that and how investors should perhaps be thinking about these corrections when they come. Lots in the personal finance and fund section that they will talk about on their podcast, which they record tomorrow. And lots in the comment section as well. And actually lots of news too. Been quite a busy week. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Alex. And thank you, Jonas. And thank you, Dan and Kent Simon. Pick up the magazine in all good news agents, The Property Forecast, The Outlook for Real Estate in 2018, £4.90 in all good news agents, or get on the website and subscribe. Speak soon.